manage it during times when you need the water.
I sort of want to follow up on this. I don't have it exactly straight, what I'm trying to ask you, but I live in Raleigh, so I'm dealing with Falls Lake and the reservoir being so low. If I want it to be recharged, is it better for us to have like a 10-inch rain, one giant episode, or do we want 5 2-inch rains or 10 1-inch rains? What's best to recharge our water?
That's a good question. The timing and the intensity of the rain are both important. And it really depends on what season it falls. If you want recharge to the base flow in the groundwater supply, those 5 2-inch rains are much more useful than the 1 10-inch rain. But if the ground's already wet and you've got a major reservoir and you can capture all the flow that comes down the streams, that 10-inch rain can go a long way towards recharging your major reservoir. So it really depends on what your water supply is. Well, if you're city of Raleigh, you should be praying for any kind of rain right now. Or if you're Durham, you should be praying for any kind of rain right now. Oh, that's the other trick you may not be aware of. So city of Durham wants their reservoirs to fill up first, and they're the ones that will control a lot of the upstream flow before it ever gets down to Falls Reservoir. So while that can help maintain the flow coming down into Falls Reservoir, city of Durham really wants theirs to fill up first, so they're gonna hold on to a little bit more before it gets down to city of Raleigh. Their reservoirs are a lot smaller, too. But depending on what your water supply is, you are very sensitive to the timing and the intensity of the rain. Again, if you're on groundwater or you have a pipe that's in the river and you're really worried about the base flow into that, which really is just groundwater, the shallow groundwater flows into the streams and provides all of the base flow that you see in the rivers right now. What you see in the river, when you drive over a bridge and you see the river right now, unless you're downstream of a reservoir, it's groundwater that's flowing into the stream basin. When a storm comes, that stream spikes and then goes right back down to where it is. So that doesn't do you any good if you just have a pipe in the stream. If that stream's below your pipe, you're SOL. If you have a groundwater supply, it takes many, many months for it to work its way back down into the system and recharge it. So you want to have more frequent rains that keep the moisture moving in and don't let it evaporate. So if in some cases, during the summertime, a big 10-inch rain can go a longer way towards helping a reservoir than 5 2-inch rains because it may just all evaporate off. But in the wintertime, in many ways, it doesn't matter. It almost all goes to recharge.
Yes, you mentioned the drought and the floods. And how they're linked on is we do more development, there's more impervious surfaces, so you have more flooding. Why don't we introduce policies for more rain-catching mechanisms? That way, when we get more rain, it catches it, and then it just doesn't all flood away and have a drought.
excuse me. Very good point. This is not my area of expertise, but I'll try to address it. Yes, we could probably introduce some policies to do that. I will say this, though, that in times when you do have those really heavy rains and you want to capture a lot of that runoff into the reservoirs, having all those impervious surfaces is really nice. Because it doesn't go into the ground. It flows right into the rivers and right into the reservoir. So if you're concerned about the reservoir, preventing the moisture from all going right into being absorbed by the ground can actually be a little more helpful. But no one really mentions that. A lot of it, again, depends on the time of year. In the summertime, a storm comes through. The more natural surface, the more natural vegetation you have, you can really do a lot to prevent the flooding that would occur. In the wintertime, the vegetation is dormant. The topsoil is generally saturated anyway. That same storm comes through in the wintertime. It's all going to go to runoff anyway. So it's a real challenge there. There are concerns about the impervious surfaces. And one of the reasons why we may be, and it's been suggested that we may be becoming more sensitive to drought, especially these hydrological droughts that are very much influenced by lack of groundwater supply, is because we have more impervious surfaces. So the water, the amount of water in the groundwater system that's available for base flow into the streams isn't what it used to be. That's one of the concerns. It's very tough for us to quantify this because we really don't understand all of the underground geology and the water recharge rates that are associated.
I actually have two questions. The first one is, does the city of Raleigh offer discounts for water-saving faucet heads like Durham County? And if not, where can they be found, and what's the range of costs? And that's the first question.
I don't know.
Oh.
Maybe one of our other folks know. Oh, we have a lovely. Oh, please, let's. Can we get her a microphone? She knows.
Okay. Hold on.
She's going to save my rear here.
In Home Depot, they have these water saving kits that you can get for $10, and it's in a little bag by the showerhead section, and it comes with one new showerhead and two faucets. Things you screw into the faucet, and one for your sink and for the toilet. So it's really good and it's really cheap, and you can install it, and they have all instructions by yourself. I installed mine, and it was really easy, and it saves a lot of water.
What she said. You have another question. I hope I can answer the other one.
My second question is, do you have any advice for farms who have horses or livestock in regards to grass and drinking water for them? That's just personal. I have a horse and sort of making me nervous.
In particular, the horses have been one of the hardest hit because there isn't a market to really sell them off. There is a Hay Alert website in North Carolina. State of North Carolina, Department of Agriculture, is doing quite a bit to identify other hay resources out of the state. They're importing quite a bit from, I believe, New York, and I've been assured today, in fact, that this is really good hay that they're bringing down from New York, and that it is available to be purchased. You can even get reimbursement from a couple of different funding sources for the transportation costs. They're doing a lot to try and make sure that the livestock that we have in the state right now survives through until we can get that early season pasture growth to come into effect. I believe if you go to North Carolina Department, ncagr.com, ncagriculture.com, I believe on the front page there's a blinking thing that says Hay Alert site, and it's putting everyone in touch. And it's been a very successful program. They're kicking their butt over in Department of Agriculture to help make this thing work.
Hello. I was going to ask, do you think enough is being done to educate the general public about not just why they need to save water, but how to go about it in terms of if the average usage in a household is about 50 gallons and they're asking for people to cut to 25, that's half of their water usage. And a lot of people might read that and say, yeah, we really need to cut down, but not quite get around to going about it. Do you think enough is being done to educate people or not?
That's a tough question. First of all, I have no clue who's talking.
Over here.
Oh, hi. Thanks for being here. Okay. Water conservation and water education is a long-term effort. It's not something that you can do in a few weeks or a few months. City of Greensboro has been educating their public for the past, 10 years about how to conserve water, and they've been enforcing it pretty tough. But they've gotten to the point now where they have a very astute community. City of Cary has also been, Town of Cary has been very successful with this. It takes time. It's completely rethinking the way we use water. And we're not used to that here in the Southeast. We're wet here. I mean, Arizona would love to get 35 inches. I mean, 35 inches for us is a drought. Arizona would be tickled to get 35 inches of rain in a year. We have a lot of water here. We just don't really know how to use it all. And so it's going to take a long time for us. Is there enough education? Gosh, is there ever? Certainly there's a lot more that can be done from the very earliest ages in the schools to let students know how they can save their water. Can there be building policies put into effect? Can there be other community policies put into effect to help us conserve our water? Certainly. We're just not used to it. It's something that's going to take a long time for us to do, but I tell you, with the growing population in this state and our sensitivity to both short-term and longer-term droughts here, it's something that's going to become more important if we want to continue to grow.
Okay, this question's kind of got two parts. We use water. It goes to the water treatment plant. It's put back in the river. So I'm curious about that ratio that refeeds the streams. And secondly, what's the percent water used here for golf courses and large things that are like golf courses? I understand they use a lot of water.
Two good questions. The first one, in municipal systems, generally you let's make this graphic. You flush a toilet, it goes into a water treatment system where they clean out as much of the bad stuff as they can, and they put it right back into the stream. So they pull out the solids, they treat it to make it nice and clean, and it's pretty clean water. And they put it back into the streams, which then goes downstream, and someone else pulls it out and uses it again. And that happens over and over again, especially the Cape Fear is a good example of multiple systems that pull out, discharge. So much so that for a while there, I don't know if this is still true, I know for a while there, City of Wilmington didn't have to add fluoride to their water system. There was enough in there already from all the upstream usage. I heard several water resource experts state very openly that most of the base flow in some of these rivers is effluent. Coming from upstream. Now, this has been treated water. It's pretty clean stuff. Water treatment folks will sit there and drink it straight out of the tap saying, hey, this is clean water. It's not really doing any damage to the rivers. I don't know enough about it to be comfortable doing that myself, but I'll have to take their word at it. So a lot of what is, especially during times of drought, is the base flow in some of the streams, especially at the end of the stream where it goes into the ocean, is a lot of effluent. My simple mind can't handle the second question. Can you repeat it? Golf courses, thank you. I don't have exact numbers on you to be able to tell how much of it is used. I do know that a lot of the major golf courses have their own private wells because they use quite a bit of water, or they use treated water, so they're not using drinking water because it's a lot cheaper. And they do a tremendous amount of irrigation. However, especially the bigger golf courses are very astute because it's so expensive for them to irrigate. They don't over-irrigate. They are very astute and monitor the health of the grass and only put down what's needed because it's extremely expensive for them to put down more. However, I do know that as a general rule, in particular for the Triangle, water usage in the summertime is double what it is in the winter. Almost all of that is outdoor irrigation for landscapes, grass. And we're going to probably see that this summer, that a good way to conserve water is to not have any outdoor irrigation. The trick becomes that a lot of people have invested substantial amounts of money in their landscapes, and they don't want to lose that. And so you get into a choice, a priority. What's the most important use for this water? And one of the things that we're going to have to do in this state, and certainly at the municipal level, is decide what are the priorities for the water supply that we do have. And when it's in times of limited situations, where we're going to have to make choices, and it's going to be tough choices, and we all need to bear in mind that some people are going to suffer. Certainly, many people are already suffering in terms of their businesses because of the water restrictions that have been put in place. And it's not something you can't just, say, oh gosh, we don't need those car washes, let's shut them down. That's a livelihood for some people. And so it's got business influences and certainly other economic impacts. And there are businesses that use a lot of water. I think Siler City is a good example of the poultry processing plants there. That was jobs for a lot of people. And they couldn't really cut down on their water use without having to lay people off. And it's becoming it's a big deal. So while the golf courses may be big users of the water, and we need to prioritize how it gets used, that's business for a lot of people. And it's going to be tough decisions and tough choices that we as a society make on how that water gets allocated.
Does anybody at any level of government ever come to you and say, calculate for us with your hydrological models what the maximum sustainable population for a given area is in, say, a 2-sigma dry period, and then try to manage their population via building permits or whatever techniques they have to keep their population to that limit?
They don't come to me and ask that. I guess they know better. but I do know that all of the municipal systems in this state have to have drought management plans, and certainly when they're looking at growth for the next, 20, 50 years, what they're looking at is what is the expected growth, what is the water usage, the consumption for that growth, and then will they have adequate water during times of drought? And they base that based on usually what's been they look at the worst drought on record and define that. Of course, in 2007, we defined the new worst drought on record. North Carolina statewide average for 2007, number one driest year with modern records going back to 1895. So even if we had done everything right, we would still have problems last year. But yes, those water supply managers that are looking at allocations and growth in the future, they are very concerned with making sure that there's adequate supply, not only during the wet times and the normal times, but also during the dry times. The problem also then is that those folks may make recommendations to whatever political body that ultimately has the final decision. But those are the folks that generally tend to have the final type decision as to what gets zoned, how much growth is allowed, all of those things. And it's a real balancing act to try and make it work. And gosh, I wouldn't want to be in their shoes. You never catch me running for city council or anything like that, because they got really tough decisions to make with these kinds of things. But that's certainly something that falls into their decision-making process, or at least it should if it doesn't. Any responsible elected official will take that into account. Certainly the water supply managers for the municipalities are certainly taking that into consideration.
As a civil engineer, I can attest to the tap water cleanliness in Wilmington. I guess I read the article, the same one that you're talking about the News and Observer, where they actually they talked about the fact that the Falls Lake was, they knew there was that it was under capacity or under design capacity back in the 80s, or the early 80s, I guess. So I guess, first of all, don't blame the Corps for it if, you know, that's indeed the case. The city of Raleigh probably didn't know that, or already knew that. But I guess my question was similar to his in terms of, I was just thinking about what amount of policy are they setting based on what you're doing. And I guess my major question is the drought more connected to water usage and development, especially with the city of Raleigh, rather than actual rainfall, given that the Corps let out all this water in the spring, and it was like we were at capacity. The city of Raleigh knew what the water level was going to be and then didn't stop developing or issuing permits to develop or let other people use our water.
Well, I hear cheers. I'm sorry to say, at least in terms of last year, it wouldn't have made a difference. Letting all those new development go in last year wouldn't have made a difference. Now, if we had been able to forecast the drought was coming, we could have held back a lot of that water. They wouldn't have let all that water out, but we didn't know a drought was coming. We certainly didn't expect it to be as severe as it was. And we're looking at an event that occurred once in our entire modern record. It went well beyond even the worst-case scenarios of even that some of the pessimists expected. But in terms of longer-term growth, yeah, that's something they've got to be concerned about. How much growth can we handle? Can City of Raleigh handle? Not only City of Raleigh, but all the folks that they supply, because it's not just them. They feed most of the municipalities in Wake County, except for I guess Cary and Apex, are fed by City of Raleigh. So they've got to be concerned with not only what growth happens in the City of Raleigh, but also what happens in the surrounding county, because they supply water to them too. That's got to be something that is in the back of their head. And if they want to continue to see the growth, we got to find new supplies for water. And I know that they're thinking about it, but there's no easy answer.
I just wanted to make a comment about pastures. And different species of grass use radically different amounts of water. So it's not a short-term solution. Short-term solution is probably the department's hay site you mentioned. But for the future, you may want to think about what you grow, and some of the farmers that I know are balancing using different species in different pastures.
And if I understand correctly, unfortunately for all those barren fields right now, the seed to reseed those pastures has gone way up. It's like triple the price for the seed now. So it's not a cheap time of a cheap year to be trying to reseed everything. But it's funny because there's a lot of mixed uses out there, and a lot of the grasses that use a lot of moisture or need a lot of moisture also do a lot of nitrogen uptake, and so are used primarily, especially on these spray fields for lagoons, and so you use a different type of seed there that you might use for other forage.
Yeah, one of the problems is the more drought-tolerant grasses are also less productive in terms of tonnage.
Right.
Okay, we have somebody.
I've got two questions.
Okay, give me the first one first.
Okay. All right, here's the first one.
I have a short-term memory here.
Okay. I'm trying to understand how far ahead scientists are comfortable predicting the next pattern. You said, we didn't see this drought coming. So I'm beginning to think, well, how far ahead are you comfortable looking? And then how far beyond that are we just completely blind and we really don't know what we're going to see? That's the first question.
Good question. It's really a matter of the season. We have skill with winter forecasts. So come June, July, we're going to have start evolving confidence about 6 months out for what's going to happen in the winter. But 6 months from now, going into the summer, I don't have a clue. And really neither does anyone else. And so it really does depend on the season. And we only have those that confidence for the winter outlook only if you have an El Nino event or a La Nina event. There's a neutral phase that's in between the two. And there, you can't always predict one to the other really more than about 6 months out. But if you get into what's called a neutral phase during the winter, it's, again, kind of a crapshoot. It's equal chances of above normal, below normal, and near normal, and which translates to we don't know in scientific terms. Though we have lots of scientific terms for I don't know. That's just one of them. But your next question.
And that feeds into this question. Can you talk a little bit about the historical data? You touched on it a little bit. You said you have records back to 1895. And as you go back and to 1895 and look broadly at the patterns to current, do you see any patterns at all in that that make sense and tell us anything? Or is it just, again, a crapshoot?
There's a lot of signal in the historical data. There's even more noise. And what we need is a way to filter out all the noise. We have a highly variable climate here in North Carolina. Climate in North Carolina is the average of extremes. And unfortunately, with all that variability in the statistical record, it's very difficult for us to pick out any type of trend. And we're trying to look at new ways of analyzing the data and trying picking out specific events so that we can filter out some of the noise and get more signal from it. Right now, we haven't had a whole lot of success simply because it's so incredibly variable.
My question as well is following up on the issue of predictability. You were mentioning that some of the tropical storms that are out in the ocean we can really predict. And I was wondering when Katy was the high pressure and was blowing, and you said that lots of times we have that. I wondered how predictable it is that Katy will be there. How unusual was it last year that she wasn't? And how much are we likely to be able to predict that she'll be there this coming year?
Again, that's a summertime phenomenon. During the wintertime, we don't have that high pressure system. Katy does not dominate us. That Bermuda high pressure system is the predominant weather feature that influences our weather in the summertime. In the wintertime, the jet stream dives further south. We have a lot more cold. You don't see a lot of cold fronts in the summertime. I wish we did. Make a little, the climate a little more bearable in the summer. But we don't see a lot of cold fronts in the winter. Those cold fronts stay further north. The jet stream stays further north. And so the cold fronts still continue to track over New England and area, and they have cold fronts come through, but they don't get all the way into the southeastern United States. So that presence of that high-pressure system is what determines really the weather patterns that we see in the summertime. And it's fairly persistent and dominant. How unusual was it that it was over the Gulf Coast states instead of over Bermuda last year? Unfortunately, we don't have as much information there. We don't have mapping of where the high-pressure system was going back 100 years. We have to use the precipitation records as proxies for that. So we can look at the frequency, and basically comes down to what's the frequency of our drought. You can say with quite a bit of confidence, if that high-pressure system is located there and persistent there, that we're going to have a drought. We don't have the skill yet to in the summertime to even give a forecast more than really a couple days. Okay, I can give you a forecast right now for July. It's going to be a high of 92, a low of 72, and a chance of thunderstorms. Well, that's a pretty good forecast, isn't it? But what we don't have the skill to do is say where those thunderstorms are going to pop up, what frequency they're going to pop up, how much rain are they going to put out. Whereas now I can tell you with some confidence that in a couple days we're going to have a storm system moving through, and it's going to bring precipitation, maybe even some frozen precipitation. And we don't have that ability, even in the summertime, to predict what's going to happen 1 to 2 days out. That's why the summertime forecast is almost the same every day. In the winter, it varies more because there's a lot more energy in the atmosphere moving through, and we have some predictability there. But in the summertime, we don't have the ability, even a couple days in advance, to show where that high-pressure system is going to shift. And we don't know from week to week if it's going to be sitting over the Gulf Coast states or if it's going to be over Bermuda. It's called the Bermuda High because it generally sits over Bermuda. But for some strange reason, and we don't understand why, it shifted and was fairly persistent over the Gulf Coast states last year. There's a lot of folks scratching their heads going, gosh, wouldn't it be nice if we could figure out how to forecast this? Because then we could forecast drought in the southeast. And it's not just for North Carolina. The entire southeast, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Tennessee, we're all influenced by it. It's very much a regional issue this past year.
Back in 1980, the Speaker of the North Carolina House, Carl Stewart, ran for Lieutenant Governor. One of his main campaign platforms was actually a statewide water resource planning. He lost. Nobody's had that as a campaign platform since then. But do you think it's the kind of issue that warrants a statewide approach, or is it a something that requires a local planning and local commitment? And then along with that, what seems to be the interest of the General Assembly when you were down there? Is it to do statewide planning?
It's mixed. Water resources in this state are very much managed at the local level. They report some data back to the state, and I have fortunate to see some of that information that gets reported back. That's the beauty of being at a university. You get access to a lot of this information, but they don't come and chew you out when you screw up some policy. So, there's a lot of discussion about that right now. And yes, the General Assembly is interested in trying to figure out a way, but they don't want to take the power away from the local officials who really have the responsibility for providing the local water to their constituents. And, you know, I think with some justification feel that they have want to have the power to make the decisions that are best for their community. Because as soon as the state comes in and tells them what to do, you're going to irritate a lot of people. And I wouldn't necessarily argue that a solution that's good for one part of the state is the best solution for another part of the state. Certainly we see that right now across the western half of the state. We rely pretty much on reservoirs and streams. In the eastern half of the state, it's a lot of reliance on groundwater. Developing a policy that works well for all those communities at the state level is going to be a real challenge. Instead, the state water plan is really made up of a combination of all of the local water supply plans, which are required to have drought response mechanisms in place. That was implemented. That was a requirement that was implemented after 2002 drought. So you have to have a drought response component to your water supply plan for your community. But there are others that suggest, no, we need to be able to manage this at a statewide level so that we can better allocate water across the state so that we can share resources among those that have water with those that don't have water. That gets into a whole lot of other interesting issues about interbasin transfers and moving water where they have it, where they don't, and all of the downstream issues. We're under a lawsuit right now from the state of South Carolina. Opens up a whole huge can of worms there, but there is a comprehensive water allocation study that's being undertaken right now by the General Assembly and their staff, and it's probably going to take several years to look at, but they're doing it.
Just sort of follow up on that, is there any conservation policies your office is advocating for both personal and communities?
I don't know if I'm going to get trapped into that one. Again, the luxury
it's
being
not a trap question, it's advice. Yeah.
Again, the luxury of being at the university is we don't spend so much time looking at the policies. But one of the things, if I had to answer, and I will answer the question, what each community needs to do is prioritize their water supply. Figure out how much is needed for drinking, how much is needed for basic health, how much is needed for all of the other uses that we have for water, for industrial use, for irrigation, and prioritize those. And then make decisions for, okay, when we get into tough times, What are we going to do? What's going to take the first hit? To some extent, we already do that with the restrictions that are in place. We tend to knock out things like, okay, let's limit some irrigation. You don't need to irrigate every day. You can only irrigate a few days a week. Of course, if you irrigate all day on those few days a week, it doesn't really do any good. But we're doing that to some extent. I think what we need to do is really formalize that policy. And there's going to be a very interesting debate around that. Prioritizing our water as a commodity is not an easy decision-making process.
Thank you. My question is, not only would we talk about prioritizing, but would you speak to the issue of privatization of water in state, specifically in Wake County?
Gosh, I'm sorry to say, I hadn't really thought about it other than, I mean, you have really two sources of water. You have private water, which is generally tends to be private wells, which we have lots of those, and then you have the public water supply. whether or not that should be privatized. Gosh, I haven't really thought about it, unfortunately. Gosh, I feel like that's a lousy question for me to end on, because I don't have a good answer. Can we take another one?
I'll ask you one.
I'm terribly sorry, but I really don't know.
I've never used a microphone, so I'm not sure where to put it. that's not a good thing to say either. I wonder, with this whole situation, is it more a matter of drought or is it more a matter of our wastefulness? If we were to be more careful, if there were more policies, if there was more conservation in public schools and in buildings and in homes, as far as, you know, how toilets and sinks and all this stuff, would that help enough? Where even if we were in a drought situation, we didn't have enough rain, if people were more careful, would that be enough?
There are cities in the United States that get a lot less rain than we do and use a lot less water than we do. But again, it takes time to transition that from a let's admit it, we're fairly wasteful when it comes to water because we have so much of it, to transitioning that into a society and a local community that is very conscientious, I guess, is a good way of their water usage. That's going to take time. So yes, we could all use a lot less water, but it's going to come down towards making choices. And it's not just, okay, do we put in low flow, you know, toilets, and do we put in low flow shower heads? That can go a long way to helping, but that's not going to prevent the kind of problems that we've seen, I think, last year. It's going to be changing our landscape. It's going to be changing our lifestyle in many ways and rethinking how we do it. And in some ways, that may even impact our quality of life. I mean, certainly we like having our lush green lawns. We like having all the trees we have. Those all take water. And it means really changing our entire landscape of how we think about living here in North Carolina. But I'm not so sure if it's, you know, how far we can go with that. The drought that we had in 2007 is not likely to occur next year. We're going to still feel the remnants of it. But should we, and what steps should we as a society take to prepare for that 1-in-100-year event? These are tough choices. But certainly if we want to continue to grow and have enough water to do everything that we want, we're going to have to start thinking about the water supply that we have and the water demands that we have and finding ways to minimize our demand and maximizing our supply.
Excellent. So with that, I think let's thank Dr. Ryan Boyles for coming here, doing a great presentation, and we'll let you eat. I think he'll be around eating, so if you need to talk to him, he'll be here.
I'm not going anywhere. Feel free to come up and ask me a question.